This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. In just a bit, we'll hear my interview with Stephen Colbert, in which he talks about some of the music that means a lot to him. But first, with winter approaching, Bridget Lancaster and Jack Bishop of America's Test Kitchen are going to share recipes for some of their favorite cold weather dishes and drinks. Lancaster and Bishop have contributed to the latest Cook's Illustrated book, The Science of Good Cooking. It features 400 recipes along with explanations of the fundamental principles behind the recipes. Bridget Lancaster, Jack Bishop, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why did you want to do a book on the science of cooking?
Cook's Illustrated magazine for the last 20 years has really been writing about food and the science of cooking. And I thought it was time to really put together a manual of best practices and to really explain how food works from a scientific perspective and to really take all of that accumulated knowledge that we had gained over 20 years of recipe testing and put it into a single book for the person who really wants to learn to cook or become a better cook through the lens of science, analysis, testing, and improving.
Bridget, you contributed several of the recipes in this new book, The Science of Good Cooking. So is the beef stew recipe one of yours?
The beef stew recipe, actually, the beef stew recipe that runs in that is not directly mine, but I'd say that I'm the grandmother of that recipe, perhaps.
Okay.
There's a lot of science that went behind choosing every single ingredient, and a lot of that was done in the early days. But this is a great example of a recipe that we thought we knew everything about beef stew, and then we went back and we questioned certain aspects of it. How can you get a beef stew that tastes amazingly beefy with meat that's super succulent, juicy, melt in your mouth, but also working with supermarket ingredients like canned beef broth? How could that ever produce such a rich, flavorful, and unctuous beef stew?
Okay, so let's talk about beef stew because it's a great winter dish.
Oh, yes.
And it's the cold weather. Cold weather is coming.
It's on its way.
Or it's here, depending on where you are. first of all, with the beef stew, you suggest do not buy stew meat. Why not, and what should you buy?
Well, meat that's already pre-cut up into pieces and labeled as stew meat, we're not actually sure exactly where that came from in the cow. There's a couple problems with it. One is it's hard to identify if it's from one of the better cuts, say the chuck or the shoulder area of the cow, has tons of intramuscular fat and collagen running through it. So when that beef is cooked nice and slow, the collagen melts and it turns into gelatin. The gelatin's what gives that stew meat that really silky feel. And that's what we want. Sometimes stew meat comes from the sirloin, which is a leaner cut, or from the round, which is not the best thing for stewing. So that's one of the problems, is getting, you know, the right cut. But the other problem is the size of stew meat. Often you get stew meat and it's tiny, tiny pieces of meat. Well, during that long, slow cooking, the meat really, really shrinks. So if you want meat that's not going to fall apart in the stew, you want to start with bigger, chunkier pieces of beef. So definitely good to get a chuck eye roast or a chuck roast from the shoulder, a blade at the very least. But a chuck eye is great. And cut it up yourself. It takes 10 to 15 minutes, really, to do it.
And what else are you putting in?
Oh, a lot of good stuff. So we want a beef stew that tastes really rich, very, very beefy. So beef will, oddly enough, only get you part of the way there. So one of the things that we find is that adding ingredients that contain a lot of glutamates. Glutamates are a savory compound. Basically, your tongue says, wow, this is beefy or this is savory if it tastes a glutamate. So things like tomato paste or salt pork, mushrooms. But in this case, one of the odd ingredients that we used was anchovies.
And this gets to one of the principles that I really love from your book, which is combining the glutamates with things like anchovies or sardines.
Uh-huh.
So explain what's going on scientifically and what happens when these two groups of tastes combine.
Right. So the glutamates, which I mentioned before, it's a savory compound. Your taste receptors will pick that up and say, wow, this is nice and savory. But anchovies in particular, they contain something else. It's another compound called a nucleotide. And a nucleotide plus a glutamate basically is a savory explosion. It really amps up the flavor of the glutamates 20, 30, even perhaps 40 times. So if you're tasting beef on its own or soy sauce or anything, any of those glutamate-rich ingredients, your tongue will say, wow, this is very beefy. You add something with nucleotides in it, say anchovies, and you'll say, this is the best beef stew ever. It tastes so much more meaty than meat, believe it or not.
So tell us the foods in both categories, the nucleotides and the glutamates.
Well, glutamates and the anchovies also contain glutamates, I should say. So salt pork, tomato paste, the anchovies I mentioned before, soy sauce is used a lot. Worcestershire sauce, meat in general. Those are probably the most common ones. So things like the anchovies are really rich in the nucleotides. Jack, I don't know offhand.
Dried mushrooms are another good source of nucleotides. As Bridget was saying, all those things from the sea, shrimp, believe it or not, sea urchins. Not sure we're going to throw those into beef stew anytime soon. But, that combination, as Bridget said, really just makes tremendously complex, meaty flavor. And we use that in a lot of our cooking, even in dishes where you wouldn't think, where meat is not necessarily the star. Thinking about like in a tomato sauce and ramping up the savory, sort of generally savory notes in something, using both glutamates and nucleotides can be a great way to make something more flavorful.
I want to ask you both about some of the principles, some of the scientific principles that are in the new book, The Science of Good Cooking. I didn't know this, but putting sugar on fish will brown it. I've kind of used that principle by just, putting on, this might appall you, putting on teriyaki sauce at the last minute, and that really helps brown it, I found. But, because I'm putting it on while it's still in the pan.
Sure.
Okay. So, but you suggest just sprinkling on some sugar.
Well, it makes a little bit of sense if you think about what you're cooking. You're cooking a piece of fish. So to brown it, say, in a skillet, you don't want that fish to stay in there for a long, long time because fish cooks very quickly. So in order to speed up the browning, which, again, browning creates a lot of flavor, not only do we salt and pepper the fish, but just add, a little sprinkling of sugar at that point because the sugar will quickly caramelize. It doesn't taste sweet at all, but it translates to a deeper flavor very quickly. And, this trick works great with chicken breasts, or we use it on very lean pork chops, things like that, cutlets, things that you want to brown quickly, but they're in danger of overcooking if they were to spend all day in the pan, getting a nice dark dark color.
Okay. In your book, you say marinades don't tenderize meats. But if you're going to do a marinade, a salty marinade works best. What are the scientific principles behind marinades and why some marinades work and some don't?
I'll take this one, Terry.
Sure.
Your classic marinade, pretty much everyone has done this at some point in their life, is to use a bottle of Italian salad dressing. And your thinking, at least the common thinking, is that the acid, the vinegar in the salad dressing or lemon juice or red wine is somehow tenderizing the meat. And you will read this in a lot of classic cooking manuals that an acidic marinade will make meat more tender. It will, in fact, make the outer layer of the meat a bit mushy, but what it's really doing is pulling moisture out of the meat and making it drier. And there isn't really a great way to tenderize a cut that's going to be cooking very quickly, for instance, on the grill. But you can make it juicier, and juiciness, when it gets to eating the steak, often is equated with tenderness once it's in our mouth. And so we use a salt-based marinade. You can use salt itself. You can use a salty ingredient like soy sauce, and then mix that with the garlic, with all the other seasonings that you want to use. And what you're basically doing is the salt penetrates very quickly into the meat, changes the structure of the muscle proteins so that when the muscle proteins are cooked, they will hold on to more of their juices. The great challenge in any sort of protein cookery is that the more you cook it, the more flavor that you're developing on the exterior, but the more moisture is evaporating. And so what a salty marinade will do will slow down the process of the moisture evaporating and the steak or the chicken cutlet drying out. It'll also provide some nice seasoning so that it gives you time to get some nice browning and to fully cook that piece of meat.
And if you're going with a salty marinade, how long would you do that for?
30 minutes. You know, of course, it will depend upon the strength. But if you're making a marinade, let's say with, you know, a third of a cup or a quarter of a cup of soy sauce, you always want to throw oil in with the marinade because the oil will distribute a lot of the fat-soluble compounds that are in spices and in herbs evenly throughout the meat. And then you can add, you know, your dried spices, your herbs. And then what we usually do is we don't put the acidic ingredient in the marinade. It's something that we might use at serving time, for instance. So if you're marinating chicken cutlets and you like, or chicken breasts and you like the idea of lemon, serve it with lemon wedges and use a squirt of the lemon at that point. But throwing the lemon into the marinade, at least the lemon juice, really is just making the meat mushy and dry.
Okay. Another question that you write about in The Science of Good Cooking is, you know, the relative merits of cooking with water and cooking with air. And, you know, you say water is a more efficient conductor of heat than air and is capable of cooking food very quickly. An oven cooks more slowly. So how do you weigh the relative merits between, you know, cooking with water and cooking in the oven and combining the two? You know, having moisture in, you know, kind of like a stew, moisture in the oven. Moisture in the pot that you're cooking in the oven.
Sure. I think the moist cooking environments, what you were talking about, stewing, braising is another one where it's a more of a shallow, think of it as a shallow stew with slightly larger pieces of meat, or even pot roasting. So the pot would contain at least halfway up the sides liquid and you're pot roasting a nice big piece of beef or pork. I think you choose these methods. You choose a slow, moist cooking method, stewing, braising, or pot roasting, for a couple of reasons. One, the moisture really does do a great job of breaking down the intramuscular fat. It also, the water or the liquid in the pan is not going to go above 210, 211 degrees. At that point, it would start to boil and turn to steam. So you're already using a much lower heat than you can control with dry roasting. And then the other reason is you like gravy. I mean, I could put gravy on just about anything. So the moist, the moisture gives tenderness to the meat, but then, or the whatever food you're doing, and then the food gives an amazing flavor, creating a sauce at the same time. So I think with really, really tough cuts, my preference is, my personal preference is for moist heat cooking. There are exceptions to that. We did a slow roasted beef, and we've done actually slow roasted pork as well, but the slow roasted beef was kind of the first time we took an insanely tough cut around, a beef round, and cooked it at an incredibly low temperature. To basically, because what we found was at this really, really low temperature, there are enzymes inside beef that tenderize it. I think it's below, the meat has to be below 122 degrees. I'm pretty sure that's at the cutoff point. But below 122 degrees, the enzymes that are turned on by this low heat method, they act almost like little buzz saws in there, and they cut down the tough connective tissue in a really, really tough cut of meat. And several hours later, you end up with a roast that, I mean, before this experiment, I probably would have not roasted a round from the beef. It's not my ideal cut. But after this, it was amazing. The beef was so much more flavorful, and it was so incredibly tender. You didn't need a knife to cut it. So either way you're going, the braising, the stewing, or slow oven roasting, they're all different methods of slowly breaking down meat, tough cuts, to make them much more tender.
Okay, so speaking of slow cooking, what do you both think of crock pots?
I love them.
I'm a convert. As somebody who never used a crock pot until about 3 years ago, I'm convinced.
What are your favorite dishes to make in the crock pot?
My favorite things are anything that benefits from, you know, slow, low cooking. You know, if it's I see recipes that people try to roast a chicken in a crock pot. That seems a little kind of crazy to me. It's not really the best use of a crock pot. And so I make chili in a crock pot. The advantage is that you can do all the prep work and, you know, go out of the house and go do things for 8 hours and come back and the chili is ready to serve. Stews are great in a crock pot. A beef stew is just, you know, wonderful in a crock pot. You do need to adjust recipes. A couple of things I found is that you need to add more flavorful ingredients, and there's almost no evaporation. And so sometimes you need to cut back the amount of liquid that you would normally use. Otherwise, the end product can be a little on the sort of soupy side. But I love them.
I'm the same way, and I'm a year-round slow cooker fan in the winter. During the holidays, I think I'm one of the last five people on Earth to only own one oven. So the slow cooker becomes my second oven. If I have a lot of people over, I will say for Thanksgiving, I'll have a roast turkey, but I'm not going to roast two turkeys. So I'll have a roast turkey and I'll have a stew on the side. And then in the summer, I don't want to turn on my oven because it's an old oven. It heats up the whole house. So again, it's a great time, a great piece of equipment to use. And the other thing that I like to make in it is, and I know it's not true barbecue, but I love to make things like pulled pork, pulled chicken, all these things that really translate well to the slow cooker.
So Bridget, I think you've been hanging around with cooks too long if you're the only person you know who doesn't have two ovens. I don't think I know anybody who has two ovens.
I think you're probably right.
Yeah. Think about that. You like to rest meat in between, you know, cooking it and carving it. And that's in part to keep the juices in.
Definitely. And that's, I think that's one of the most overlooked steps of any recipe. The difference between resting meat, cutting into meat that's rested for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and meat that has not rested at all, and you cut right into it, it's amazing. So basically, you take a piece of meat out of the oven, and the fibers are very tight, so they're bound together. So if you were to cut into that meat right away, all the moisture that's inside that meat will just flood out onto your cutting board. Well, that means dry meat, really moist cutting board. So if you're enjoying cutting board for dinner, you're all set, but the meat will be dry. But by letting that roast sit there for at least, depending on the size of the roast, at least 10, 15, 20 minutes. 20 minutes, to me, is the minimum. The meat fibers, which were really, really tight, are now starting to relax. The juices that were pushed to the outside of the meat are now able to reabsorb back into it. And then you can cut into the meat. The meat will be juicy. You'll have very little loss of juice to your cutting board. It's worth it, I think, to especially, you know, really expensive roast or just about anything to let it sit there for at least 20 minutes.
So with winter on the way, I'd like you to each recommend your favorite cold weather drink, not scotch.
Darn it.
like something that you actually make.
Cold weather drink. For me, it's probably mulled cider, and you can choose to put a little Calvados into that if you care for. Nice cider from, you know, the local orchard if you can. And you can bloom the spices, your cinnamon stick, break it up, your nutmeg, whatever you like in that. I think mulled cider for me is, and I don't really have a recipe. I kind of throw things in higgledy-piggledy until it tastes good, and a little bourbon at the end is perfect.
And Jack?
For me, it's hot cocoa. Hot cocoa, as the name implies, I think should be made with cocoa powder rather than chocolate. Believe it or not, cocoa powder has two or three times much flavor as an equivalent amount of chocolate, because chocolate also has fat in it, and cocoa powder is pretty much pure cocoa solids, meaning pure flavor and very little of the cocoa butter, which is the fat. And so I will take a small amount of cocoa powder, mix it with a small amount of sugar, and then a small amount of milk, and dissolving them, sort of whisking them together to make a sort of thick paste, and then adding the remainder of the milk in order to thin that out. And I think it's really important. I usually use skim milk in my cereal, but I think if you're going to make hot cocoa, you kind of want to use whole milk. And then a little teeny bit of salt. In a lot of beverages that have sugar in them, adding a pinch of salt will kind of balance out the sweetness and heighten the flavors the way it does in savory foods.
Well, I have to say that tastes and smells very good the way I'm imagining it. And speaking of cocoa, I mean, you suggest in recipes, for instance, like chocolate cupcakes, that you use cocoa instead of chocolate, or at least make some substitution there.
Yeah, it's this principle is really interesting, that people think, oh, bar chocolate has the best flavor, because they're thinking about their experience of, you know, eating it out of the package, and you're not going to eat unsweetened cocoa powder. But chocolate actually is 50% cocoa butter, which is the fat that's in bar chocolate that gives it that luscious texture, and it's 50% cocoa solids. Cocoa solids are what makes chocolate taste like chocolate. And so in order to make cocoa powder, they take pure chocolate that's half fat and half cocoa solids and remove almost all of the fat. And so spoonful for spoonful, it's just got an intense amount of chocolate flavor. And so when we're making cupcakes, when we are making cakes, even when we're making chocolate mousse or frosting, you will often rely on cocoa powder. And in order to sort of unlock all of the flavor that's in those cocoa solids, we found it's really important to do a technique called blooming. So a lot of old-fashioned recipes that might call for cocoa powder, let's say you were making a cupcake, you would just add it with the flour and the other dry ingredients and, you know, add it at the end. We find that that is not sufficient. What you really need to do is pour hot liquid. It can be water. Coffee is great, brewed coffee, over the cocoa powder in a bowl to dissolve the cocoa powder fully and sort of unlock all the flavor that's trapped inside of those cocoa solids. And then you can use that cocoa powder in the cake batter. That's basically the liquid ingredient rather than adding milk, which you would usually do at the end of making a cake or a cupcake, along with the dry ingredients. You're alternating adding this bloomed cocoa along with the flour. And it's just a great way to make a super intense chocolate cake.
Jack Bishop and Bridget Lancaster work on the public TV programs America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country. They've contributed to the new Cook's Illustrated book, The Science of Good Cooking. The new movie Life of Pi is director Ang Lee's adaptation of the 2001 best-selling novel by Jan Martel. Told mostly in flashback, it's about a boy from India who survives a shipwreck and is lost at sea, adrift on a lifeboat with a Bengal tiger that also survived. The movie was shot in 3D. The Bengal tiger was created with CGI. David Edelstein has this review.
Ang Lee has a surprising affinity for the Indian hero of Life of Pi. That's his name, Pi, and he's seen at several ages, but principally as a 17-year-old boy adrift on a lifeboat in the South Pacific, the lone survivor of a shipwreck that killed the crew, his family, and a variety of zoo animals his father was transporting for sale to North America. Actually, Pi is the lone human survivor. He shares his boat and its dwindling food supplies with a man-eating Bengal tiger. Lee is a director whose works I've admired more than loved. All his movies, among them Sense and Sensibility, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Brokeback Mountain, even Hulk, center on emotions that bump up against rigid codes of behavior, emotions that can't be suppressed and finally erupt. Lee's range of genres and settings is impressive, but there's something about his meticulousness that keeps me at a distance. I know that many people loved Brokeback Mountain, but I got hung up on the mythical cowboy iconography, that forbidden love sanctified by Purple Mountain majesties. Lee makes movies about giving in to passion without seeming to let go. But Life of Pi is different. Most of the film is a flashback, a tale told to a writer by the middle-aged Pi. And the way that Lee depicts it, in a style that's typically fastidious and arty, is astonishingly in sync with his narrator. That lifeboat, in which most of the movie takes place, is a wondrous set, not realistic, but not fake either, transcendentally in between. The water is ultra-ultramarine, the sea a mirror in which clouds above seem to mingle with sharks, dorados, luminous jellyfish, even whales below. The orange of the tiger burns as bright as in William Blake's immortal poem. The 3D is brilliantly effective in creating multiple planes of reality, and it also allows Lee to hold shots for longer than any studio would let him, if not for that marvelously immersive technology. This isn't just a gorgeous survival story. The search for higher meaning runs all through the movie, as it does through Jan Martel's best-selling novel. Growing up, Pi was drawn to multiple faiths. He thanks Vishnu for introducing him to Christ, while rolling out his prayer mat to honor Allah. The kid subscribes to everything. But on that lifeboat, it seems as if none of his many gods will even acknowledge his existence. He's terribly alone, except, of course, for you-know-who. And talk about a mismatched buddy picture. Because of a bureaucratic screw-up, the tiger bears the name of the man who caught him, Richard Parker. But despite that human moniker, the beast is never anthropomorphized. For long stretches, Pi stares at the tiger with both awe and dread.
I never thought a small piece of shade could bring me so much happiness, that a pile of tools, a bucket, a knife, a pencil might become my greatest treasures, or that knowing Richard Parker was here might ever bring me peace. In times like these, I remember that he has as little experience of the real world as I do. We were both raised in a zoo by the same master. Now we've been orphaned, left to face our ultimate master together. Without Richard Parker, I would have died by now. My fear of him keeps me alert. Tending to his needs gives my life purpose.
The young actor, Suraj Sharma, has a good, wiry presence. He's alert to everything, as he needs to be. Irfan Khan, as the older Pi, has the more thankless job, largely just sitting and telling his story to a writer played by Rafe Spall. Those framing scenes are awfully clunky, but against all odds, they pay off. The movie has a sting in its tail that puts what you've seen in a startlingly harsh context. The over-controlled Ang Lee has gone with his strengths and made a movie that's passionately over-controlled. If it seems one step removed from reality, under glass, with twinkles of magic that are obviously computer-generated, well, that penchant for artifice is the key to the film. Like Pi, Lee believes with all his heart in the transformative power of storytelling. Only one thing about this lovely movie saddens me. Once upon a time, audiences would say, "Wow, how'd they do that?" Some people might read about how it was done later. Most would never find out. Now, you can't get away from the behind-the-scenes documentaries on cable and the internet. The DVD will have a raft of extras showing Richard Parker and that lifeboat at every stage of its computer generation. I wish we could just say, wow, and leave it at that.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Life of Pi, the new film directed by Ang Lee. Coming up, Stephen Colbert shares some of the music that means a lot to him. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. Last month, I interviewed Stephen Colbert about his new book, America Again. Today, we have part two of that interview. Colbert's TV show, The Colbert Report, is largely political satire, but he loves music and loves to sing. He often sings with the musical guests on his show. And last year, Colbert performed in the New York Philharmonic's production of Stephen Sondheim's musical Company. So for part two of my interview with Stephen Colbert, I wanted to talk with him about music. So I've made it clear to you several times on Fresh Air when you've been a guest in the past that I love it when you sing. I love it when you sing on stage. I love it when you sing on your show. I love it when you sing with guests on your show. So someday I hope maybe you'll sing on our show. But in the meantime...
That'd be fun.
In the meantime, we asked you to bring some of your favorite recordings so we could talk about music. And so you sent us the names of a few recordings. We have them ready to play. So I thought we'd start with the first one, which is a song from Jesus Christ Superstar, which I assume you first heard when you were very young.
So, yeah, I think it was probably 7 or 8 when I first heard it.
And was
the Broadway cast recording.
The Broadway cast recording. Okay. And yeah. How did you hear it?
One of my brothers and sisters had it, maybe my sister Lulu. And just for the record, Terry.
Yes.
The three songs that I picked for today, they're not necessarily my favorite recordings. I just thought, like, what are just three songs that mean something to me and are, almost specifically aren't my favorite recordings? I just thought of three different aspects of my life, and I thought, okay, are there any songs that just speak to that? And the first one would be Herod's song, King Herod's song from Jesus Christ Superstar. And I just remember hearing it as a kid, and it's an upbeat, contemporary song in an otherwise very, very serious, musical. And it's the only song that's sort of comedic in Jesus Christ Superstar. And as a child, I remember thinking it was scandalous because the lyrics go, Herod is facing Jesus and he says, "Oh, so you are the Christ, y'all, the great Jesus Christ. Prove to me that you're no fool. Walk across my swimming pool. If you do that for me, then I'll let you go free. Come on, King of the Jews." And I thought as a kid, like, oh, that's so blasphemous. That's so scandalous. And yet I loved the song because I was from a fairly devout family. But even as a young kid, my mom said, no, that's fine. That's exactly how they would have spoken to him.
Far worse.
That's just a you know what I mean? But that's like a theatrical expression of mm-hmm. contempt. And that opened my eyes as a kid that you could actually be wrong in character. You could be blasphemous in character and it doesn't negate how you feel about the subject. The greatest example is just because I play a murderer doesn't mean I'm a murderer. In the same way, you could actually mock Christ in this song, effectively mock Christ, and comedically mock Christ, and yet it's not a mockery of the story.
Well, that's kind of like you were 7 and figured out what it means to be in character, which you now are so much of the time on your show. It's like this is the roots. This is the roots of your character.
Well, certainly my ability – certainly it's the first time I thought, oh, you can make jokes about religion that aren't anti-religious.
Right. Great. Okay. So let's hear the version from the original cast recording, 1970, Jesus Christ Superstar, and here it is.
Jesus, I am overjoyed to meet you face to face. You've been getting quite a name all around the place. Healing cripples, raising from the dead. And now I understand you're God. At least that's what you've said. So you are the Christ, you're the great Jesus Christ. Prove to me that you're divine. Change my water into wine. That's all you need to, and I'll know it's all true. Come on, King of the Jews. Jesus, you just won't believe the hit you've made round here. You are all we talk about, the wonder of the year. Oh, what a pity if it's all a lie. Still, I'm sure that you can rock the cynics if you try. So you are the Christ, you're the great Jesus Christ.
So that's King Herod's song from the original Broadway cast recording of Jesus Christ Superstar, one of the recordings that Stephen Colbert brought with him when we asked him to bring some recordings that have meant something to him over the years. And we did this because
I could do that whole musical, by the way.
Were you ever in it? It's one of those musicals, everybody was in Hair.
No. I'm not really a musical guy, but I if you just started like the opening, down, like the opening of Jesus Christ Superstar, I could probably sing every note and every word from the beginning to end.
Okay.
I love that musical. So, I don't even know if it's good. You know what I mean? At this point, I have no idea whether it's even a good musical. It's just too much like in my DNA.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So let's move on to another recording. And this is a Ben Folds 5 recording. And perhaps not coincidentally, he was just on your show.
Yeah, it was on my show 2 nights ago. And I really like Ben Folds. And every night, actually, at my show, just for fun, at one of the commercial breaks, we'll usually play his song, Stephen's Last Night in Town. And we'll sometimes play, I love the song Philosophy by Ben Folds, and I like a lot of his stuff. But there's one particular song that I just love called The Best Imitation of Myself. And there's sort of an obvious resonance for me because I do an imitation of myself professionally. And the lyrics go, you know, I feel like a quote out of context, withholding the rest, so I can be for you who you want to see. I got the gesture and sound, got the timing down. It's uncanny. Yeah, you'd think it was me. Do you think I should take a class to lose my southern accent? Did I make me up or make the face till it stuck? I do the best imitation of myself. And when I first heard the song, it was just a few years ago, actually, somehow the song had escaped my notice, I just thought he'd written it for me. But then when I listened to it more, I thought it's just a beautiful expression of how we are toward each other as people. We don't think that we are sufficient for each other, that no one wants to know the real me or the whole me. I just want to give you the part of me that I think you expect to see from me, almost as if that little part of me is more than the whole of me, because I don't want to give you any of the poison. I only want to give you the meat of me. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And this constant slight changing of our mask, or as Eliot says in Proof Rock, time to prepare a face for the faces that we meet. But what's beautiful about the song to me is that we all play the entertainer for each other.
Yeah.
Just some of us do it professionally.
And some better than others. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is the Ben Folds 5, Best Imitation of Myself, one of the songs chosen by my guest, Stephen Colbert.
I feel like a quote out of context, withholding the rest, so I can be free what you want to see. I got the gesture and sounds, got the timing down. It's uncanny, yeah, you think it was me. Do you think I should take a class to lose my southern accent? Did I make me up or make the face till it stuck? I do the best imitation of myself.
That's Ben Folds 5, Best Imitation of Myself, and it's one of the songs Stephen Colbert brought with him today because we asked him to bring a few songs that really mean something to him, and we did that because I really love Stephen Colbert singing so much. So what's some of the music you grew up with in the house that your parents or older siblings were playing?
Well, I'm the youngest of 11 kids, so a lot of the music I listened to was like hand-me-down albums from them. So as a kid, I listened to a lot of James Taylor and Gordon Lightfoot and Deep Purple. I mean, it was pretty eclectic. It's whatever the older ones left behind. Nancy Sinatra, Paul Anka, Elvis Presley, mm-hmm. You know, Creedence Clearwater. It's because my eldest brothers and sisters, my brother Ed, bought an original 45 of Bill Haley and the Comets, Rock Around the Clock. But my closest brothers and sisters, you know, left behind Cat Stevens' Tea for the Tillerman. So I listened to all that because those albums were just laying around. So basically from the beginning of rock and roll through the, you know, mid-70s soft rock, folk, post-folk, feel-good festival, I listened to all of it. I didn't really have a singular music that I listened to. I can't say that I was like, I was a Who guy or I was, I mean, the Beatles were gigantic. They eclipse everything on the musical landscape. It's hard to imagine a band more important than them to me. I don't know musically, but that argument can be made, obviously. But the Beatles were the biggest and most important, but I wasn't sort of slavishly devoted like some people. Their identity was associated with a single group.
So when you were very young, did your parents play music in the house?
No, not really. We sang. We were all encouraged to sing at all times.
What, around the piano or guitar?
No, just around the house. Just around the house. Nobody in the family played piano or guitar. No one played any musical instruments. Matter of fact, my sister Mary beat up my sister Margot one day because Mary had been taking guitar lessons and Margot started playing up, running her toes across Mary's guitar. And Mary beat up Margot, and like my brother Billy had to pull Mary off of Margot and say, why did you do that? Just because she put her toes on your guitar? And Mary said, no, because she sounded better than me playing.
Oh, no. So when you sang around the house, did you sing harmony, and what songs did you sing?
No, we didn't sing harmony. Like we have a few family songs. Like, you know, at a drop of a hat, anyone in our family will sing, I am my Don Quixote, the Lord of La Mancha, my destiny calls and I go. Or we'll sing, you know, we'll sing Men of Arlek from the movie Zulu, which is kind of our family movie. We'll sing, you know, this is what they're singing when the Zulus basically breach the line and kill everybody. And Michael Caine, you know, dies in his movie debut. You know, what's it called? Like, Men of Arlek, stop your dreaming. Can't you hear those? Men of Arlek, stop your dreaming. Can't you see their spear points gleaming? See the warrior banners streaming through this battlefield. At weddings, at family weddings, the men will get on one side of the room and we'll sing Men of Arlek. And the women will be across the room and do the Zulu chant and they'll attack us. And then we'll meet in the middle of the room and hug. It's really lovely.
That's so funny.
True story.
No, were you ever in summer camp or anything like that where you had?
No. I mean, I 11 kids, it was always camp. So I didn't
right.
go to camp.
Right.
I just hung out at home. We lived on a, you know, a street with a dirt road and we had all the outdoorsy I needed.
Were you ever in a band?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I was in two bands. I was in a band in elementary school. I was in a band called Nebula 5. And there were only three of us.
Cosmic.
In Nebula 5. And because Nebula was a cool word and a cool thing. And 5, we kind of picked 5 because we thought 5 was the best number.
This it was just to foreshadow Ben Folds.
Exactly. I actually talked to Ben about this the other night, is that I didn't realize, we never occurred to us that the Jackson 5 were because there were 5 of them. You know, as an elementary school kid, you're always like, what's the best color? It's blue. Wrong, it's red. It's blue, stupid. Or like, what's the best number? It's 3. It's 5. 5 is definitely the best number. And so we thought 5 was the best number. So we were Nebula 5. It was me, Tommy Whittle, who at the time in third grade called himself Tommy London. That was his stage name. And Gray Motzinger on drums. And I sang. And then in high school, I was in a band briefly called A Shot in the Dark is what we called ourselves. And we did mostly like Rolling Stones covers. And we would like play at a party for free beer or something like that.
So did you do Mick Jagger parts?
Yeah. Like Honky Tonk Woman and stuff like that, Brown Sugar, all that kind of stuff. I'd strut around on stage.
Would you really?
In a jersey. Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, you got to move, baby. You got to move. you got to give the ladies what they want.
What would you wear?
I would wear a pair of jeans, and I would wear my brother Peter's jersey, which had a 0 on the back.
So it wasn't really tight leather pants?
It wasn't tight leather pants. It was a pretty tight jersey. Nor did I have the physique to pull it off. But again, you gotta put it out there.
Did you sing in church?
No. Uh-uh. I was never in a choir. I was in my school choir. Uh-huh. I was a bass in the school choir. And, you know, we did a lot of religious music, in my church. It was a religiously affiliated school, and so we did things like we would do like Mozart's Mass kind of religious music, and I still remember the bass line to things like the national anthem. You know, in my mind, I almost can't sing the national anthem, the melody anymore. I have to sing, you know, oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose bright stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight or the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the You know, I can't remember the melody anymore.
You have quite a range, though, because I wouldn't imagine you being able to get that low, because I know you have a nice high range.
I'm actually much more comfortable really low.
Seriously?
I'm much more – oh, yeah, yeah. I'm much more comfortable singing, you know, oh, Jesus Christ Superstar, the Caiaphas, great bass role, is no, wait, we need a more permanent solution to our problem. What then to do about Jesus of Nazareth, miracle, wonder man, hero, fools? That's the part for me is Caiaphas.
Well, now you just need to be in a production. So one more music question: if you could perform in any kind of music venue, would it be a Broadway show? Would it be a rock band? Would it be a country band? Would it be an opera with Audra McDonald? What would it be?
Probably a show. You know, because I'm an actor and I like a story. So a show. I mean, King Herod, man, playing King Herod. One song, it's in my range. Call me.
Stephen Colbert is the host of The Colbert Report. His new book is called America Again. We talked about that in part one of our interview. If you missed that, you'll find it on our website, along with an extended version of the part we just heard. That's freshair.npr.org. Everyone gather around now, sing us a song, just in case by tomorrow it happens he's gone. For 2 weeks and 7 days, our fair foreign friend, I have this feeling we might never see Stephen again. But we thought he was gone, let's go back again. Last weekend was funny, and now the joke's where he's been. Cause everyone knows now that every night now will be Stephen's last night in town. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross. Cause